We're going to read together from the book of Genesis, chapter 39, on page 42. There's Bibles about if you haven't got one. You may know that for quite a number of Sunday evenings, month by month, we've been looking at different stories in the Old Testament book of Genesis that revolve around women in the Bible, where the women play a prominent part. We looked at Eve, first of all, and then Sarah and Rebecca and Rachel and Leah, and I think last time at Tamar in chapter 38. And so today we come to Potiphar's wife, not in any sense trying to do a study on female virtue or characteristics or any of these things. There's shelves full of books that I would never write in Wesley Owen that you can read if you want to pursue that line, but simply to use these stories as a way of looking at God, because God is the subject of the Bible, and he speaks to men and women together, and that is what we want to do. And this is very much a story about a man and a woman, or two men and a woman, and perhaps one of the best known in the Bible, and therefore one that we need to pay close attention to, because we maybe think we know what it says. And this is what God does say in his word in Genesis chapter 39. Now the Ishmaelites had taken Joseph to Egypt and sold him to Potiphar, one of the king's officers, who was captain of the palace guard. And the Lord was with Joseph and made him successful, and he lived in the house of his Egyptian master, who saw that the Lord was with Joseph and made him successful in everything he did. And Potiphar was pleased with him and made him his personal servant. So he put him in charge of his house and everything he owned. And from then on, because of Joseph, the Lord blessed the household of the Egyptian and everything that he had in his house and in his fields. And Potiphar handed over everything he had to the care of Joseph and did not concern himself with anything except the food he ate. Now Joseph was well built and good-looking. And after a while, his master's wife began to desire Joseph and asked him to go to bed with her, it says in the Good News Bible. In the NIV, it simply says, she said, lie with me. He refused and said to her, look, my master does not have to concern himself with anything in the house because I am here. He's put me in charge of everything he has. I have as much authority in this house as he has, and he's not kept back anything from me except you. How then could I do such an immoral thing and sin against God? And although she asked Joseph day after day, he would not go to bed with her. But one day, when Joseph went into the house to do his work, none of the house servants was there. And she caught him by the robe and said, come to bed with me or lie with me. But he escaped and ran outside, leaving his robe in her hand. And when she saw that he had left his robe and had run out of the house, she called to her house servants and said, look at this. This Hebrew that my husband brought to the house is insulting us. He came into my room and tried to rape me, but I screamed as loud as I could. And when he heard me scream, he ran outside, leaving his robe beside me. And she kept his robe and with her until Joseph's master came home. And then she told him the same story. That Hebrew slave that you brought here came into my room and insulted me. But when I screamed, he ran outside, leaving his robe beside me. And Joseph's master was furious and had Joseph arrested and put in the prison where the king's prisoners were kept, and there he stayed. But the Lord was with Joseph and blessed him, so that the jailer was pleased with him. And he put Joseph in charge of all the other prisoners and made him responsible for everything that was done in the prison. The jailer did not have to look after anything for which Joseph was responsible, because the Lord was with Joseph and made him succeed in everything he did. Amen. And I pray that God will use these words to bless us. Good times and bad times, and then better times again for Joseph. Great. Well, if you've been reading with us through Genesis and all these stories about women, and in particular the relationships that they got themselves into, or their menfolk got themselves into, you probably, with me, breathed a huge sigh of relief that finally, at last, we've got sex out into the open in the Bible. We've had all these other relationships, and many of them have been seedy and immoral and shameful. Abraham's adultery with Hagar, and Jacob's bigamy with Leah and Rachel, and Judah's prostitution with Tamar. But in each of these stories, there's cloaks of ancient Hebrew culture or Eastern culture covering over the sex. And so behind the relationship, there's always an economic argument or a tribal custom or a family tradition or some reason for explaining why things were done as they were, which allow us to avert our trusting eyes and say, well, things were different for them. And that's often the way that this part of the Bible has been read. We've been able to, or try to, maintain our respect for the participants in the stories by saying things were different for them. But here at last, when we get to chapter 39, we get a good, straightforward, clear-cut, old-fashioned case of adultery. And no doubt that's why God brought this select group of people here this evening. This is clearly what he wanted to speak to you about. And I didn't write the Bible, and I didn't know who'd be here tonight, so don't blame me for what we're saying. But we've got this story of a woman wanting sex with a man she cannot have. And all of a sudden, the Bible is bang up to date, is it not? This is the same world as the drunken office party, or the boss and his secretary, or the group of student friends, or sometimes the close Christian fellowship, and all the other places in our experience where adultery is just a part of people's lives. And if you review the statistics, then that's just true. And you cannot step apart and say this is something that other people have to deal with, because it's human life in its fullness. What's surprising is perhaps that the lead is taken by the woman in the story. It's a story of attempted rape as well as adultery, but normally we associate that with male aggression. And there would be some interpreters of the Bible who would say that's quite probably what happened here, and this is just a typical story written by a man. Who is to say that Mrs. Potiphar was not in fact attacked by Joseph, and what we get here is his side of the story, because this is of course what he would say to his chums in prison afterwards, is it not? So poor Mrs. Potiphar was not only attacked by Joseph, but also has been subjected to centuries of abuse afterwards for complaining about it. The argument against that, apart from the fact that we believe in the truth of the Word of God, the argument against that is actually Joseph's survival. Egypt wasn't the kind of world where slaves would normally have been imprisoned for attempting to rape their master's wives. They would simply have lost their lives almost at a whim. So if Potiphar really thought that Joseph had done what his wife had said, then he wouldn't have found himself in prison at the end of chapter 39. And in fact, chapter 39, verse 19 would have been the last verse in the Bible. But Potiphar commuted the sentence to life imprisonment, and that in itself argues for Joseph's innocence. But what the story reveals, I think, is a whole host of fairly obvious reasons why adultery is not a good idea. First of all, because it makes no sense. Just count the words to emphasize that for yourself in verses 7, 8, and 9. In the Good News Bible, Mrs. Potiphar doesn't speak any words at all. That's judicious editing. In the original Hebrew, well, she spoke Egyptian, I imagine, but in the Hebrew script, she simply says two words, sikba imi, words not to repeat by accident next time you go on holiday to Israel, because they mean lie with me. And that's all she said. That was the sum total of her proposition. While Joseph's reply, if you read it from verses 8 and 9, gives a whole list of excuses extending through two long verses, several dozen words, because he's got a whole long list of reasons for not proceeding. He's got his reasons, and all she has is her desire. Now, that obviously doesn't make sexual desire sinful, as some branches of the church have argued, as if God had made a mistake when he put that bit of us in. But it draws our attention to the fact that in a holy life, thoughts and feelings should coincide. And if we find ourselves in a situation where we cannot explain what we want to do, or do not want to do what we know we should, so our feelings and our hearts and our heads are out of step with each other, well, that should set the alarm bells ringing and send us back to God in prayer and ask him to bring our hearts and our minds not only together with each other, but back together with him. And that applies to all sorts of things, not just to sexual desire, but to all those times in our lives when the only argument we have is something like, but I want to do it, or I feel like it, or I want it. And yet we use that to blow away all the reasons and do it anyway. God, who made us in his image, didn't make us to be like that. Adultery makes no sense. And then, secondly, there is no integrity in it. That's the root of Joseph's reasoned response to his lady's request. He says, I am the one who has been trusted by my master to look after his house and his fields and everything that belongs to him. So to take you now would be to break his trust. Now, that's quite a remarkable line for Joseph to take when you think about it. He himself has been a victim of broken trust. His brothers had sold him into slavery. And he might well have learned a lesson from that experience that said to him, this is a big bad world, and you just have to take the chances that life gives you. So while my boss's back is turned, I'll go and do this now, and that will balance the books of fate. So being cheated becomes an excuse for cheating others. And similarly, Joseph could have taken his own argument, my master trusts me to look after his house and all that belongs to him, and turned it on its head to say, therefore, I can do this and get away with it because he's not standing over me and watching. So he would never know. And what that means is that Joseph's reason for resisting temptation is not to say to himself, I'd better not do that in case I get caught, as if all he was afraid of was a jealous husband. It wasn't other people he was afraid of, it was himself. What would I be? What would it make me? What would it bring me to or reduce me to if I did this? I am afraid, not of what Potiphar might do to me, but of what I would do to myself if I let this happen. So he's protecting his own integrity, his trustworthy nature. He's already been bullied and abused by kidnap and by conspiracy, and he doesn't now want to add to that suffering the sacrifice of himself. He's been a victim of other people's crimes. He doesn't now want to become a victim of his own opportunities. And it's when we abandon that integrity, of course, that our society begins to crumble. It's the criminal who says, this act will be fine so long as I don't get caught, and cannot restrain himself or herself, and that's why we need police forces and the courts. And the moralist simply says, well, this should be okay because it's being done by consenting adults and nobody else gets hurt. And so we give ourselves the permission to dismantle our integrity which Joseph refuses to take. There's no integrity in adultery. And there's also no morality in it. You probably noticed that at the end of verse 9, Joseph's argument, although the list of reasons he gives to Mrs. Potiphar makes sense in themselves, and he could have simply rounded off his argument by saying to her, "Now do you say, dear, why I just can't do this?" It wouldn't work. The way he actually concludes it is by saying, "How then could I do such an immoral thing and sin against God?" So it's not just about her, and it's not just about him, and it's not just about Potiphar. It's also about the God whom he serves. Now, we know that every sin is a sin against God. He is the one that we disappoint and dishonor every time we do less than we should. So we need to avoid the easy Christian trap of setting what happens in Genesis, or nearly happens in Genesis chapter 39, apart, and making sex a different kind of sin that we store in that file marked unforgivable, that we fill up with gay people and prostitutes and single mothers and rapists and paedophiles, and thank God that we are not like that, because we know that the Bible puts sexual sin in the same list as things like obesity and gossiping and unkindness and drunkenness, all of which are equally without excuse. Nevertheless, I think there is something different about what is being suggested to Joseph here that he recognizes, and that's why he issues this rebuttal. How could I do such an immoral thing and sin against God? And it's that firm strand of Christian teaching that begins in Genesis chapter 2 when Adam and Eve come together and runs right the way through the Bible that explains to us that marriage is more than just a social convenience and more than just a way of organizing childcare. It's a covenant. And that term covenant is proud and strong in Bible teaching, a covenant that God made with Abraham in Genesis, the covenant that God made with Moses and the people of Israel at Sinai, and the covenant that the new covenant Jesus Christ makes with the church in his blood. That's a marriage is in the same parcel. And it also involves a partnership like that which exists within the Trinity. You know what it says in Genesis chapter 1? God says, "Let us make man in our own image. Male and female, he created them." And then the two became one. And so there's something very similar between the covenant of marriage and the oneness of the married couple and the Trinitarian nature of God himself. Let us make him in our image. Male and female, he created them. And the two became one. So a happy marriage, when it happens, is an eloquent hymn of praise, not just to the goodness of God in giving us a gift, but to the nature of God himself and to his love for his people. This is how he is and how he expresses himself. Now, obviously, and tragically, marriages do sometimes collapse by themselves, and as in so many other ways, the image of God in us is tarnished, and that's always a Christian tragedy. But when it comes to adultery, when it comes to a third person outside of the marriage trying to tear open what God has joined together and force her way in or his way in, or for one of the two inside the marriage to invite a third person into what should be exclusive, is to go against the nature of God. It's to undermine his way of being with us, and all our experience of him should just scream out at us and say, "That's not right. How can I do this moral thing and sin against God?" And also, quite obviously, there's just no truth in it. Although adultery happens all the time, it's not often what will be the conversation on Monday morning. "What did you get up to the weekend?" "I went to the park, I went to the football." "Oh, I committed adultery." It doesn't often happen. It makes people into liars. And we saw in Ezekiel this morning how much contrary to the nature of God that is. Look at how cleverly Mrs. Potiphar does that. Nothing has happened. She could simply have put Joseph's coat in the bin and said no more about it, but she feels she's got to justify herself. She's got to say something, and she's got to condemn the one that she presumably said she loved in order to get him into her bed. But see how cleverly she does it. The truth is, the story tells us, that he fled, leaving his robe, and then she called out to the servants. What she says to them and to her husband is that she called out and he fled, leaving his robe. Is that a lie? Did she describe anything that didn't actually happen? It's quite possible that the remnants of her conscience were stirred up here, and she said, "This is what happened, Potiphar." And by the time she's told the story once or twice, she probably starts to believe her own version of events. And so what she starts to do to herself is burden herself with the responsibility of telling a lie that's just going to have to get bigger and bigger as time goes on, and harder to maintain, because there's just no truth in it. And how much easier it would have been to only have had to tell the truth in the first place, because there was nothing to hide. So adultery clearly has nothing to commend itself here, in case you had any doubts about that before we began. And that's perhaps a message that we need to reinforce in our own hearts and minds, because it's not at all clear that the society we live in today would come to that conclusion. But perhaps the question that we also need to ask ourselves is, what could Joseph have done about this? To the extent that this is a moral tale, what lessons can we learn from it? Obviously not to be like Mrs. Potiphar and try to do what she did, because that doesn't work. But what if we are like Joseph? Could this innocent man have done anything to escape from what happened to him? Well, in one sense, of course, Joseph did escape. He escaped in the sense that his reputation remained intact. Not perhaps with Potiphar, who condemned him as a rapist and would-be adulterer. So one man didn't like him, and that man was important, and the incident might well have cost him his life, and he'd have gone to his grave unmourned by anybody in the kingdom of Egypt. But nevertheless, his reputation with God is secure, and by accident also with millions of Bible readers since, who Joseph presumably never thought would read his story, but they have done, and they know and they honour his integrity. And that's important, because there are times when we as Christians need to bear the disdain, the criticism, the mockery, the abuse, the raillery, the attacks, by all present company, and sometimes by significant numbers of people, and sometimes by those who are influential, and sometimes by those whom we need to admire us if we are to get along in a comfortable way. And we need to bear that disapproval in order to gain the approval of a higher audience still. And that's what Joseph does. That's how he survives, with his integrity intact. First of all, by knowing the truth. He was probably rocked backwards in surprise and shock and horror the first time Mrs. Potiphar came up to him in verse 7 and said, "Lie with me." It surely wasn't what he'd been expecting and hadn't seen it coming. And yet it's clear he knew what his reaction to that approach ought to be. He didn't have to go home and look up his dictionary of Christian ethics to see what a well-brought-up believer should have done. His gut reaction was sound, because he knew the truth before he needed it. And then he maintained his integrity also by living the truth, because after the initial shocking suggestion in verse 7, the opportunity goes on and on. In verse 8, she asks Joseph day after day if she would go to bed with him. And he lived the truth so that his success rate against the temptation to sin was not 50% or 80% or 97%. In other words, he didn't only agree to sleep with her one day a month. He just didn't do it at all. So that temptation like that, which has to be resisted every day, every time we open our eyes, every time we switch on our TV, every time we let the words of other people inside our heads, every time we go and mingle with the world around us, that temptation is resisted not just by knowing the right answer once, but by being in a relationship with God that is renewed as often as it comes under attack. And then finally he did it by keeping the truth, so that when she ran out of patience and her tactic of lying in wait and issuing invitations gave way into the violent ambush which occurs when she grabs him in the end, his reaction was just as decisive as hers had been. He fled. Even though he ran straight into the arms of the law and quite possibly saw what was coming, and yet still wouldn't have run any other way. So know the truth so that you're prepared for the surprise, and live the truth for when you're surrounded every day, and keep the truth even though it means taking risks and being exposed to danger. And as I say, Joseph does escape, because as the story ends, we don't find him languishing in prison, but rather we see a picture of God's faithfulness matching Joseph's own commitment to someone else's marriage. Just as God blessed him in Potiphar's house, so God blesses him in the prison. And you probably noticed that as we read in English, and even more clearly in Hebrew verses 1 to 6 and verses 19 to 23, or verses 1 to 5 and 19 to 23, are almost word for word the same, except that Potiphar and the jailer and Potiphar's house and the prison change over. But the same person is blessed by the same God to the same effect of being entrusted with greater responsibility and being a blessing to those around him. So just as God blessed him in Potiphar's house, so God blessed him in the prison. And just as Potiphar learned to trust him, so did the jailer. And just as he had succeeded in all he did before, so he began to do once again. And it shows us that under the faithfulness of God, even a victim of sexual abuse and attack is neither forgotten nor crippled. And things seem not to have gone according to plan, and yet God is still on track. But there's actually something more than this. As we step back and see the sweep of Genesis, with Genesis chapter 39 as just a part of it, and realize it's not only a moral tale, but a revelation of the unfolding picture of God's dealings with his people. And what we see, I think, is the beginning of a new age dawning, and a new element to the relationship between God and man, God and humankind. Because up to now, what we've seen is a pattern in Genesis of blessing. God created Adam and Eve and put them in a beautiful garden. God rescued Noah and his family and brought them safely to dry land. God called Abraham and led him into the promised land, and so on right the way through. A pattern of blessing followed by temptation, giving way to sin, which then has to be confessed and forgiven. And that seems to be the ongoing pattern of how God sustains his people. But then we come to Genesis chapter 39, and a new possibility dawns, where God blesses his people. And then temptation comes, but instead of giving way to sin, it is resisted. And the man of God grows and emerges at the end of the story looking like a hero. Joseph, we're told, was well-built and good-looking. And that's how he appeared to Potiphar's wife. But he appears more than that in a wholesome spiritual sense to us when we estimate his conduct. And surely just as much to God, who I think glows with pride at the end of the chapter. So at last we get a glimpse of a human race that doesn't always need to be God's charity case, rescued once again from self-imposed danger, but a human race that is in fact God's family doing what God would have done in this situation, showing the world what God is like, living our lives like his, and a picture of God himself who begins to look less like a nursemaid whose job it is to dry the tears and kiss the bruises of children who never learn, and looks more like a father who knows how to bring up his children and nurture them towards physical and spiritual maturity. So it's a story of temptation, and it's dirty and sordid and just such a tragedy that this happens not only in ancient stories but to us and to people around us. Sin's conspiracy. But also, it turns out, God's opportunity to make us what he wants us to be. And the conclusion is clear in verse 23. The Lord was with Joseph and made him succeed in everything he did. Pray that we could be the children of God of whom he can be proud as we live in a world like that.